Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, KUOW's Storywallahs series invites locals with roots in India and South Asia to tell a five-minute story. The theme this time was belonging. In this episode, you'll hear stories about what it's like to become a citizen of the United States, sometimes welcomed, sometimes not. Storywallahs Belonging took place on April 23rd at ACT Theater. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find additional stories on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, series host Augusta Kohli introduces the talks.
My name is Augusta Kohli. I lead the drama wing of Pratidhwani. And, well, I come from India. Specifically Punjab in India. And if you asked my father where he was from, he would probably say, we Kohlis belong to Punjab. Belong. Well, belonging, that's our theme. And that's where I'm going with this. So do I belong to Punjab? I grew up in Delhi. I visited Punjab, but I never really lived there. And I don't like onions in my food. I don't like deep fried food too much. My white American wife eats spicier food than I do. So, you know, if you asked a Punjabi, they would tell you, I don't belong to Punjab. So belonging, it's a complicated situation. Can you belong in a relationship if the other side of that relationship says you don't belong? Can I belong to a place even if the place doesn't belong to me? And vice versa? I don't know. So I grew up in Delhi, then I moved to Chicago, and I was there for my bachelor's. And the year I started at Illinois Tech was one of the largest classes that Illinois Tech had in terms of incoming freshmen. And they had a little musical chairs game that they had to play in terms of finding a dorm room for everybody who was coming in. Eventually, when people would pledge to fraternities and move out of the dorms, they knew they would have enough room for everyone. But until that point, they had to do something. So the housing department at the university actually rented rooms for the fraternities and put some of the incoming freshmen in those frat houses on campus. I happened to be one of those kids. And I was 18. I was new to the US. I was unfamiliar with the American university system. I sure as heck didn't know what a fraternity was. And I was in this room the first night I spent in Chicago. And let me tell you, my gut instinct was, I don't belong. Right? This is not what I was expecting. And I say my gut instinct because, you know, had I spent a considerable or any significant amount of time there, my opinion would have evolved, it would have probably changed, and I would have felt differently, but I didn't have that opportunity. Soon enough, they were able to move me into the dorms, and there were 150 other Indian students who had either come in with my class or were there already from previous years. And they, in addition to the university orientation that was going on, they gave us the Indian orientation that we needed. And I felt at home, right? There was no reason to be homesick. There was no reason to be worried. There was no sense of I'm lost or I don't know what to do next. We were well taken care of. One of the guys who was there who became a really good friend of mine later on lent me Tide so I could do laundry right away. I belonged. There was no problem. After graduation, I moved to Dallas and I got a job there. And Dallas, Texas, it's a different kind of place. And what I discovered is that I could win no argument with anybody, even if we were talking about how many isotopes of uranium there are and which one has a greater half-life and which one has a less half-life, because my Mazda Protege was smaller than their Ford F-250. I certainly did not belong. I moved to Seattle. First week, I was in Bellevue, went to Crossroads. There was a jazz thing going on stage in Marketplace, and people were playing chess on this huge, gigantic floor. I belonged, all of a sudden. Anyway, so I guess I'm not really telling you a story. What I'm saying is it is unclear to me what it means to belong. And thank God we have this evening dedicated to the theme because our storywallahs are going to tell us what it means, I hope. Of course, in this political climate lately, there's been a lot of discussion amongst immigrant communities of belonging, and I wouldn't be surprised if we explore that a little bit too, but there can be many different ways to belong or not, and everything in between. So let's get started. Without a hat here, which I will come get in a minute, I'm just going to ask Sheba Jacobs to come up here and tell us her story. I have no idea what she's going to say, but here's Sheba.
So my father once told the story of when he was 7 years old, growing up in a small town in Kerala, India. And Chaco was the name of the chief cook who worked alongside my dad's mom. My dad used to come from school, and the first thing he would yell out was, "What do we have for snacks?" And he never liked spicy food. He would complain to Chaco about the snacks. And my grandmother would get so mad at him and say, "You should go to America. There's no spicy food there." And he also told the story of when he was accepted into medical school in Padua, Italy. And his journey started in the fall of 1960 on a boat called the Oceana. And ironically, while they served him plates and plates of this delicious Italian spaghetti, he countered the non-spicy taste with a little bit of mango pickle he snuck on the ship. And I have these countless memories from childhood when we would get McDonald's and the first thing my dad would do when we got home was deconstruct his quarter pounder with cheese, put the burger on the skillet, and add a little bit of spice for flavor. So these days, I see how the adding of cumin and coriander is this attempt to stay connected to home, thousands of miles away, to feel this sense of belonging when all other things may feel just a little too foreign. Whenever we migrate, we take this bit of ourselves to our new homes, our histories, our stories, and ourselves. And we imagine this homeland. And Zadie Smith says it beautifully. She says, "Homeland is one of those magical fantasy words like unicorn and soul and infinity that have now passed into our language." In the year 2004, I was living in Bangalore, India, and I found myself acting very similar to my father. I had a friend mail me Italian spices so my roommate and I could cook this precious food from our homeland. And we would watch bootlegged versions of Sex and the City and buy bootlegged bottles of wine so we could feel American. At the same time, there was something simmering below the oregano and basil, and I realized the more I spent time in India, the more I felt like I belonged. And sure, those first few months were full of confusion and cultural miscommunications and a longing for comfort, but as time passes and we occupy these new spaces, we just begin to transform. So I found one of my last journal entries before I left the country, and it was sharing how, yep, I'm at Junichaichi's right now after visiting my dad's side of the family, having a cousin's reunion. I get back to Chicago on May 1st, and I believe the first few weeks I'm going to be in somewhat of a daze. And then I proceeded to cheers, and I said, "To my amazing students, Raj, the store vendor in Jaipur who spoke Spanish, Hindi, and English, to afternoon naps with my amma as warm rains poured heavily outside, to street kids and their intellect, to toddy tappers in the land of the coconut, carved up stories of Ram and Sita, and to a thousand stars in a Kerala village, to a whole country being a muse." And when I reintegrated back into the States, I longed for this other world, so much that when I returned back to New York City, I would yearn for Indo-Chinese food and often tell my sixth grade students stories from my time in India. I witnessed my father doing this as he told stories about Italy when we were in America. These places we resettle, they grow on us, whether we like it or not, and if possible, I realize we just begin to make these places in our hearts for them too. And in these best of times, we're malleable and we adapt to our circumstances, and our heart actually feels that sense of belonging. And in the best of times, the relationship actually feels symbiotic. These new homelands welcome us, and over time, there's these stories of isolation that get removed, and resistance gets removed too for stories of wonder, belonging, and hope. And I'm so thankful India and I were ready for each other, just like Italy was ready for my dad. So here we are today, immigrants, children of immigrants, grandchildren of immigrants living in this United States of America. And we use a variety of spices to remind our palates and our hearts that there is this other magical homeland we don't want to forget, lest we forget ourselves. And at the same time, we really want to live here. So what do we do when this geopolitical space we're occupying right now may be trying to convince us this place is not our homeland? What do we do when suddenly new homelands don't welcome us? I say we cheers. So cheers to Spanish Harlem in New York City, where you can get mango on a popsicle stick carved out into a tulip, to Devon Street in Chicago, where India and Pakistan finally have a chance to shake hands and live peacefully together, to incredible parents who come here with dreams for their children, to the red, white, and blue, and the brown, cinnamon, honey, the black, the yellow, and the gold, to my former student, Jorge, who had to cross fronteras in the middle of the night and finally end up on U.S. soil, to the mixture of broken speak, of English, Spanish, French, Creole, of Tagalog, Malayalam, of Hindi, to the blues song that sings ever so softly around the horizon of a bayou, to that mural on Rainier Ave where the painter intentionally put a splash of burnt yellow in the upper left corner that sparks that fire internally in ourselves, to that fire in all of us that allows us to re-envision and recreate stories instead of accepting the ones told to us, to upholding what the character of this country was meant to be, soulful, determined, strong, multidimensional, hybrid, complex, poetic, profound. Cheers. I think we could all belong to something like this. Thank you.
I already picked out a name from the hat, but I had to prove it to you. I have a hat. Michael Pereira, come on up. His story is about leaving home to move to the U.S.
So just to be clear, I am actually the first person, so there's absolutely no pressure on this. I really find it difficult to talk about where I'm from. When people ask me that question, I get a lot. I try to avoid the question. I try to avoid the answer. So I'll see what I can do here. I am Sri Lankan, but I was born in Dubai. I have a vaguely American accent, but it sounds slightly British, enough so that people think I'm sexy or smart, but only one at a time. So the question becomes, for me, where is home? Or to put it another way, where do I belong? My passport says I'm Sri Lankan, but I don't speak the language. I've never lived there for any period of time. I don't know the customs or the culture, and even my parents don't want me to move back there. I have a birth certificate that was issued by a hospital in Dubai, but I don't know the language there. And not being an Emirati citizen, I cannot legally go back to that country. I've been in the United States since 2003, but for over a decade, the immigration system has been squeezing and strangling me in one way or another to the point where I have to wonder, do I even belong here? I've been here since 2003, but is this my home? For the first 5 years that I lived in Washington State, I had two different jobs. I was going to grad school, I had a car, I had an apartment, and I had it made. I thought I had everything I needed. But as is usually the case, things stopped working, one thing at a time. I got laid off from the first job I had. The second job I had, my boss turned out to be legitimately crazy. I spent all my life savings on immigration options that didn't work. I lost my car, I lost the apartment, and then I had to live for 5 long years in a tiny studio room, and I had to do work that I found absolutely meaningless. There were times I wanted to quit. There were times I wished I could have gone anywhere else, but I couldn't go back to Dubai. I didn't want to go back to Sri Lanka, and I was too broke to go anywhere else. And I found myself wondering if I really belonged anywhere. But for some reason, and maybe it was because I had no other option, I stayed in Seattle. And Seattle became a place that I liked to be. Seattle became a place where I wanted to be. After years of wondering if I was fated to live in that tiny studio room, I moved to a beautiful neighborhood just on the doorstep of the University of Washington. When I wondered if I would do nothing but work in those meaningless jobs, completely insubstantial, I came into my own as a writer and a researcher. And after years of loneliness and heartbreak, I found community and friends that gave me a sense of purpose and that gave me a sense of belonging. A few weeks ago, I went to Citizen University at Town Hall, Seattle. And at the end of the event, all of us in the audience, we got up and we all sang along to "This Land Is Your Land." Now, I'm not American. I was not born in the United States, so I don't have that connection to the song that many people here might have. But there was a line in the song that really struck out to me, and it went something like, there was a big wall, and on it was painted "private property." But on the other side was painted "nothing," and that side was made for you and me. And I thought, I have a connection to that song now. And that's what belonging is. It's a special, unique kind of connection to a person, to an idea, or to a place. Belonging doesn't come easily. And these days when people say things like, are you here legally? Or when they say things like, go back to where you came from, it becomes harder and harder to find a place where you belong. You realize that you have a different skin color. You have a different accent. You even have a different name. So belonging doesn't come easily, but maybe it shouldn't. If we really and truly belong to a place, it takes time and it takes effort. It takes time. It takes patience and sacrifice. And to belong to somewhere means uncertainty, and it could mean hostility. But if I've learned anything about belonging, it's not just that you find a place you love. That's the easy part. Belonging is where the place loves you back, and it makes your life better in so many different ways, and you would not be anywhere else in the world but here. Belonging means singing along to an American folk song that's been around so much longer than I have, but realizing I have a voice in that song. Belonging means finding people, special people, who accept you and welcome you with open hearts and open arms. Belonging means coming to a place like this where we can tell stories and we can hear each other's stories and share what it means and share and celebrate what it means to belong. Recently, we've all been wondering what makes America great. But I think something like this reminds me that belonging is what makes America great. And that's why I am so happy to be here. Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, Storywellers is a collaboration between KUOW, Tasveer, and Pratidhwani. Rita Mayer, who runs Tasveer, is unfortunately not here tonight, but she sent me an email, and I will tell you what she wants me to tell you. Tasveer is a nonprofit film and arts organization whose mission is to inspire social change through thought-provoking film, art, and storytelling. Don't miss their next event, Tasveer Reels, on April 28th, which is Friday, and we will come back and talk about that date a little bit more later, at Bellevue Arts Museum called Talim, a film made by local filmmaker Jonathan Kumar. To find out more about their event, please go to tasveer.org. That's TASVEER.org. All right, next up, Madhura Nirke. And her story is titled, Speak the Language.
Hello, everyone. My name is Madhura Nirke. I'm a computer scientist by profession and an artist at heart. Years ago, many of us, we left the Indian subcontinent and came to this new land. Our status changed gradually from student visas or work visas to green card holders, and some of us even bit the bullet and became American citizens, eventually. But our language, which is deep-rooted in our experiences, didn't quite make it all the way. There is a definite lag, one that I'm convinced is no fault of ours. Language is nothing but words that are used to describe experiences and feelings. If they don't belong to this land, why do we expect our language to? I have a fascination for words and often muse over why Indians use language the way they do and why Indians understand each other perfectly, but our words often leave our non-Indian friends so puzzled. For example, my grandmother used to say that there are some words in the Indian language, my mother tongue being Marathi, that have no parallels in English. One such word is a head bath. What is a head bath? It is a long ritual that used to fill my Sunday mornings, mostly with my mother tugging at my hair as she used two extra buckets of hot water to wash off the homemade herbal shikakai extract, which is kind of an herbal shampoo, from my hair. It used to get into your eyes and they would tear up constantly. How do I describe a head bath to someone, right? There is another concept which in Hindi we say is jhootha. Jhootha means if In Marathi, we say ushta, which means if you are eating with the same spoon that I'm eating with, I say, don't eat that. That is juta. That isn't quite the same thing as dirty. It's not dirty. It's juta. I think about the way when I used to put my kids to bed and realize that Indian parents do this very differently from American parents. American parents tuck their kids in bed, give them a good night kiss, and then the kids are on their own. We Indian parents don't do that. We put them to sleep, literally. So, you know, you have the child on your lap and you pat them. You pat them incessantly until they get into this state of stupor where sleep sort of seems like the most welcome escape to the child. Or we resorted immediately to singing the lullabies that we knew of. Now, remember that in each of these songs, there is a deep-rooted concept called Nindya Rani. Nindya Rani is the queen of slumber. And she is this naughty, obstinate, hard-to-get queen who has to be enticed by sweet words one after the other to make an appearance. So all the songs say, Dheere se aaja re akhiyan mein, slowly come to the eyes of the little one, O slumber queen. So then how can you blame Indians for when they use phrases like, no matter what I do, sleep is just not coming to me. Is not coming reminds me of the present continuous tense that we have such an obsession for. We are a nation that lives in the present and savors every moment of it in our speech. So to answer the most unsuspecting question, if somebody asks you, do you have kids? You might get a response from an Indian, I am having 3 children. To which my immediate gut reaction is, oh my God, right this moment? Triplets? Seriously? We Indians are perpetually having a cold, taking a bath, giving an exam, which means actually taking an exam, perpetually. Although I must admit that in the current state of mind that I am in with the current political situation, it can be best described as I am having serious problems with the current president. I am losing my peace of mind, a perpetual persistent state most appropriate for use in the present continuous tense. Idioms and slang, pop culture jokes are completely, you know, foreign to us when we come from India. We really can't understand what you guys say for the first few years. For example, there is this conversation between two people where one person says, these days I drive to the gym every morning trying to lose my spare tire, you know. To which the Indian response is, spare tire? You mean the stepney? Which, thanks to the British, you know, is the word for the spare tire on your car, the tire number 5. To which you might get the response, yeah, trying step aerobics these days, kind of hard on the knees, you know. So I know I have just a minute, so I'm going to conclude. Basically, there is one word that I find it very easy to describe, what Indians describe when they are in the middle of two states, when they can't decide, you know, what it is that they want. For example, we use the word cum, which means sofa cum bed. When you don't want to buy either a sofa or a bed, you buy a sofa cum bed. We say it is a cafe cum shop, so you can go there, have a cup of coffee, and also buy something. So in that way, I think I am an American cum Indian. Take it for what it is. Thank you.
I'm going to segue into this little story from Madhura's discussion about language. I read an article a number of years ago where an Indian person who had just recently come to the U.S. went to a restaurant, and when he was done eating, he called the waiter and said, can I get the bill? And the waiter said, no, I'll give you the check. You'll give me the bill. So here we go. Before I ask the next storyteller to come up here and tell us a story, I want to talk about Pratidhwani real quick. And I promised you that we will revisit the issue of April 28th, which happens to be this coming Friday, which is also the opening night performance for Pratidhwani's dance drama Chitrangada, which is taking place, present tense, present continuous, in this building, three floors above us. So in the Allen upstairs, Chitrangada, a dance drama written by India's first Nobel laureate, Rabindranath Tagore, will be performed starting the 28th. It'll run 4 weekends. Now that all of you have figured out how to come to ACT, where to park, where do you eat before the show, you can just do it again. It's that simple now. This was considered this dress rehearsal on your behalf, on your part, for Chitrangada. Like I said, it'll run 4 weeks. Visit the Pratidhwani website, pratidhwani.org, and catch me later if you can't remember that. I will mention Chitrangada multiple times throughout the night because I've been told it takes 7 attempts before things stick, so. Amish Dave, his only memory of second grade, belonging.
So thank you so much. So growing up in the Chicago suburbs as an Indian American kid, I wanted to belong in my class more than anything else. I grew up awkward as one of only 3 Indian American, really Asian kids in my school. And my best friend was my brother. My mother was a physician and very much as a radiologist insisted that anything we do would break our bones. So we were not allowed to swim. We were not allowed to ride bikes. We were not allowed to play football or soccer. It was really awkward in general. I think that we were allowed to play chess because you couldn't figure out any way that we could possibly break our carpal bones doing that. And we were shuttled around from one temple to another to prayer services, things called pujas that many Indian American kids have some very strong memories about. But the weirdest thing about my mother was that she also had very strong opinions about how to raise kids. So my mom believed that all kids in her family, and this is a family tradition of hers, needed to have rhyming names. So my name was Amish, my brother's name was Manish, and she had family members, Ale Male, who were her brothers. One of them had daughters, Krunal and Runal. And so it was very awkward because whenever my mom or my dad would call us in front of our friends, it was Amish Manish, you know, and so Amish Manish, come here. And so it was hard to not only feel like you belonged in your class, it was hard to feel like you had a sense of place in your own family because in a sense, my brother and I blended so closely together with our names being so similar to one another. The other things about my mom is that she believed that she needed to pick out our clothes also. And so my brother and I had to wear matching sweats most of the time. And so we would wear matching sweatshirts and sweatpants that either be red or green, blue, various colors. And so as we would go to school, kids would take bets on what type of clothes we would wear or what color of clothes we would wear also. Because it was always sweats, it was just what color of clothes we'd wear. And we got a little bit frustrated with this. And so somewhere in second grade, I must have told my mom, you know, mom, I just would really like to wear something different than sweats. And I don't want to wear the same thing as my brother, who's 1 year behind me. And so my mom said, sure, I think that we can find a great outfit for you, and you'll love it. And so one day she put out a t-shirt for me and also a new pair of shorts. And I was sent to school. And I remember, you know, waiting on my cul-de-sac for the school bus to come by, and I get on the bus with my brother, with my Thomas the Train Engine lunchbox, and all of a sudden, the bus driver starts snickering and breaks out laughing. And all the kids on the school bus upon seeing me start breaking out laughing. And I sit in my seat mortified, just kind of like hiding my face and my book sack. And then get off the bus and walk into class. And I remember, you know, walking that linoleum-tiled that hallway through my second grade class, and everyone just turning around and starts breaking out laughing, all the kids. And then as teachers start looking to see what the commotion was, they start opening up their doors to look outside. They just start staring at me and literally start bursting out laughing. Some of them putting their hands to their faces turning bright red. And I went to my homeroom and I just sat down in my seat and literally everyone was kind of snickering, staring at me. And my teacher, you know, tried to hold the course of the attention of the class. This went on for a couple of hours, and at some point, I guess one of the other teachers must have told the principal, and the principal shows up the door. And I was so mortified by this. I was told, like, the worst thing ever is that the principal calls you to take you to his office. And so I get pulled out of my room, and I go to the principal's office. And literally, you know, this was in the middle of a class break, so everyone's still laughing at me as I walk over to the principal's office. And the principal sits me down at in the chair in front of his desk. I'm staring at him, and he's like, I don't think you really understand what happened here. You know, how did you decide on this outfit? And I was like, well, my mom decided to, you know, pick this outfit for me. I had no clue. And he's like, you know, someday you'll understand this, but, you know, your t-shirt says, I'm having a Mylanta moment. And that's probably why all the teachers are laughing at you, because my mom, as a physician, got all these free t-shirts from pharmaceutical companies and decided that this was the best t-shirt ever for me. And growing up in, like, this very, like, closed-off Indian-American family, I thought all underwear were Fruit of the Loom briefs. And my mom had found a pair of boxers with the American flag all over it. And so she'd sent me to school with American flag boxers and I'm having a Mylanta moment t-shirt. And this was mortifying. And so I realized, as someone who had a difficult time finding a place of belonging, at that moment, I'd found a unifying theme across all of the teachers and all of the students, which was the strong feeling, as my mom was called in for a parent-teacher conference the next day and educated about the appropriateness of what she's sending her kids to wear. That, and after that, it led to a change in how I felt like I was belonging in second grade. Thank you so much.
I do not have anything that can segue from that to anything that I was going to say. So I'm just going to ask our next speaker to come up. This is Jai Jaisimha. Come on up. And the short description of his story here says, and this is the only reason I'm inviting him now. So if you want to be called up, write something interesting and then put it in the hat. How Ayn Rand and Upton Sinclair convinced me I belong in America.
So years ago, I was a rebellious teenager, I guess for some of us, more years than others. And I discovered how powerful ideas can be. And really the idea I'm talking about is America. I realize I'm hardly the first teenager to think that his parents were from another planet, or that I was always misunderstood, or that's, you know, what India was, or the kind of society and values I was surrounded by was not for me. I really felt discontented with it. And I was thinking about, hey, why am I uncomfortable? I'm probably not, wasn't mature enough to realize why. But then I found a book, like many other things in my life. And this book was in the American Central Library. And horror of horrors, that first book I read was The Fountainhead. So here I am reading The Fountainhead, and it's all about me, me, me. It's all about the individual. And I said, wow, this sounds great. I'm a teenager. I want life to be about me. Then I picked up Upton Sinclair, The Jungle. Pretty soon I was reading about problems in meatpacking plants. The next really uplifting book I picked after that was Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Now you might be wondering why this list of, you know, rather uplifting books was gonna put me on a plane to America, or why I wanted to come here. But then I discovered Taylor Brand's Parting the Waters, started reading about Martin Luther King, how the country changed, and I realized that there was something about this place. And what I realized was that it was all about how quickly things changed. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but always back again for the better. How people made room for dreamers people like me to come in and make a home for myself. I thought, now this is a place I think I could belong to. Years went by, I came to Seattle, and a couple years later, I had a chance to make a business phone call to someone in the UK. After I said hello, she says, "Are you calling from the United States, sir?" And I was so excited. I thought, wow, this is great. My accent is changing. I'm assimilated. But you know, every now and then I'd run into people who would ask me that favorite, or actually least favorite question that every non-white immigrant gets asked. "So, where are you from?" Or my other personal favorite, "So what is your favorite Indian restaurant?" A part of me wants to scream, "Have I not worked hard enough to fit in? What did I get wrong? Is my English not good enough? Or do my clothes betray my immigrant origins?" What will it take for you to stop asking? Why aren't you asking me what my favorite Italian restaurant is, or my favorite Vietnamese restaurant, or where I like to eat steak? Don't worry, these are all with my inside voice. I never ask people these questions. I realize that my reaction is probably more about me than it is about the people doing the asking. It's probably that little feeling of insecurity. Am I welcome? Is this really where I belong? And it's a lot more about people trying really hard to relate to me with the open-minded, but sometimes naive curiosity that is one of the most endearing American qualities. So about 30 years later, I feel as American as I can possibly feel. I cheer for American teams. Most of my closest friends are native-born Americans. I've raised my kids to be American. They still eat rice and dal, of course, but meatloaf and soccer and the Boy Scouts and Macklemore are all on the menu. But still, the questions linger. Just this afternoon, my teenage son described one of his teammates as looking American. And the feelings of insecurity come boiling up. I asked him belligerently, poor kid, he's only 13, just talking about his team, "What do you mean American? Do you really mean Caucasian? Don't you consider yourself American? Do you realize that Americans come in many different colors? What is it going to take for you to feel like this is your country? This happened 3 hours ago at my house. You know you're not really Indian, don't you? All you've done is visited the country and eaten the food." A part of me is really concerned and worried about their future and how things will go for them. Will people ever stop asking them, "Where are you from?" Will my sons feel like this is their country? And then there's a part of me that wonders if I'm just overthinking it all. Just a week ago, I was at Disney World in Florida, and it was the first time I'd been in the South since the election, and I ran into people from practically every state, of every color, and I'm certain of every political persuasion, including probably people who voted for him. And I'm sure you'll never guess the first question I asked them. I asked them, "Where are you from?" And of course, eventually they turned around and asked me where I was from. And I proudly answered, "Seattle." And guess what? No one blinked. All they asked me was, "So cool, what was your favorite ride?" And that's America for you. It's a salad of people, you know, and ideas and experiences, all of us living a dream and looking to have a good time. In short, a place I'd love to belong. Thank you.
So this business of where are you from reminds me of three things that I want to share with you very quickly. One is Short Circuit. How many people remember that movie from the 80s? And there's a scene early on in the movie where the Indian guy, by the way, not played by an Indian actor, is asked, he says, "Where are you from?" And in his very fake, very bad Indian accent, he says, "You mean originally?" And he says, "Yes, I mean originally." And he goes, "Oh, Pittsburgh." And that has just sort of stayed with me, is that, yeah, originally Pittsburgh, because that's all you need to know. The The other two things I've forgotten now. Where are you from? I don't know. They'll come back to me. It's a long show. Okay. There's a completely different story, though, that I was just thinking of in terms of belonging in a completely different context. Back in 2008, I did a play with a company called Live Girls Theater, which at the time had their own venue in Ballard. And the play was called Love Person. It was Love Person. It was a bilingual play in English and ASL, American Sign Language. The play had four characters, one of which was a deaf character, which in our production was played by a deaf actor. And the other two characters were related to the deaf character, so her lover and her sister. And by virtue of that relationship with her, those characters also signed throughout the play. And so the actors who were cast in that were also signers. And then there was me, who, because it had not come across my life path in any way, I had not yet learned ASL. And there I was. And so we'd be sitting in the green room before the show, and the three of them would be having a conversation, signing, of course, and I couldn't understand a word of what they were saying, and so I would pull out my BlackBerry at the time and hide on my phone because I couldn't be a part of the conversation. I didn't belong in that conversation, and all of a sudden I went, holy crap, who can't follow the conversation now? Who's the deaf one in this room, right? So it was an interesting situation, which of course the other three actors very quickly realized that I was the outsider, and then, you know, we started to have bilingual conversations where they would speak and sign at the same time, and when I said anything, one of the three would sign for the deaf actor in the room. And we had a great time. It was a wonderful production. Too bad if you didn't see it, you missed it. But it was a great show. Speaking of great shows, our next speaker is Meenakshi, who has done a couple of great shows herself, including Dance Like a Man right here on this stage back in 2015. Meenakshi, her story is titled Potato.
So I didn't prepare anything. I didn't know whether my name would be called. So these are my notes. Belonging, yeah. I actually belong in this room, in the Bullet Theater. I've done two shows for the act on this very stage. One of them was Dance Like a Man that Auguste alluded to, where the character, and so I'm seized with a sense of longing that is part of belonging right now. Ratna was the main character that I played in that, and she didn't belong to anything, but she belonged to her own fame. And another character I played in Mother in Another Language, which was 2010, I believe, I played Meena Kanwar, who belonged to Bangladesh, but she moves to a brownstone in New York. Her son promptly puts her in a basement, and she goes about the process of learning to belong to her new country and ends up having an affair with her Italian handyman. So it was pretty nice. that was a good character. So I really don't know what belonging meant when this thing came out, that Storywalas was going to focus on belonging. I kept trying to think of what does it mean to belong? And then my mother-in-law's words echoed in my mind, which is kind of a scary thing in itself. But she calls me a potato. You know, the humble alu potato, Kartoffelt, right? And this is why she calls me a potato. You know, what is a potato? A potato can be added anywhere, and it quantitatively enhances the dish, but it qualitatively doesn't lose its essence. So how many of you think that you're potatoes? You can be put in any situation, and you belong. There you go, three. Well, thank you, potatoes. We're all potatoes, and to the potatoes of the world, I say, potatoes of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose, but maybe a little bit of your skin. Thank you.
Meenakshi Rishi, also known as the Queen of the Pun. I still can't think of what the other two things were about. about where you're from. So let me just plug Chitrangada again, right? So Chitrangada is opening April 28th. They're in tech right now in Allen. They've been working all weekend long. For those of you who are ACPass holders, of course, you can just reserve your tickets free of charge. For those of you who are not ACPass holders, maybe you are aware, maybe you're not, that there is an online charge to buy tickets if you do it online. But while you're in the building, just run upstairs to the box office tonight and get your tickets, and then you save all of that money too. So Chitrangada, Pai Pratidhwani, in the Allen, opening Friday 28th. I've done it twice now. Okay, our next speaker is Jayant. I don't have a last name here, so hopefully there's only one Jayant in the room. And the story is titled A Tale of Two Cities. Here we go.
Hello, everyone. When I came in, I was kind of feeling like Meenakshi. I wasn't really planning to talk today because I just wanted to sit and listen. And the reason is belonging. You know, the word is so innocuous, I don't think I ever thought about it. Or maybe it's you know, it's just there, right? It's just inherent. You don't really call it out. But then sitting here and then suddenly listening and hearing that word more than three times in the first minute, something happened. I said, you know what? I'm in my mid-50s and I've only lived in two cities, two-thirds of my life in Bangalore and another third in Seattle. And believe it or not, I don't think of myself as Indian or American. I think of myself as being a Bangalorean and now a Seattleite. So that was the aha when I felt, you know, okay, let me just go share this with all the wonderful people here. Now, going back to Bangalore, growing up in the 60s, I don't know, I really don't know the reason I'm so attached to that city. I never lived anywhere else. And what used to happen, the only memory I have, what may have caused it, when I used to go to school, and those days, you know, I mean, you have all these kids, and one question we were all asked is, what is your native place? It really means, you know, that little town or village where your family originated and then you moved to Bangalore. Now, I had no answer. I was like, Bangalore. But the teachers would be, no, you cannot be from Bangalore. Everybody has a native place. Go find out. I went home and we lived in a huge joint family those days. So I asked my dad, I asked my grandfather, and they all said, no, it's Bangalore. So it turned out that my grandfather, or maybe his father, great-grandfather, they had settled in Bangalore in the early 1900s. So back I went, and I told everybody that my native place is Bangalore. So ever since, you know, I've kind of seen myself as this hardcore Bangalorean. And then somewhere, I think, in and I don't know whether it was arrogance or just laid back, because those of you who know Bangaloreans will know that we are a very laid back breed of people. So when I want to do an MBA, and those days India had three top business schools. They were in Ahmedabad, Calcutta, Bangalore, ABC. And most people, you know, it was like a status symbol to even get into one of these, and they would cover their wrists and apply to all three. And I would look at people and say, no, I'm only applying to Bangalore. If I don't get in there, I won't go. I won't do an MBA. I don't know where it was coming from, but that's kind of how I was. And then things changed. You know, suddenly after I turned 35, I'm like, oh my God, all my life I've lived in one city. What about perspective? And there is a term in Sanskrit that's called kupamanduk. It just means a frog in the well, which kind of thinks the well is the world. And suddenly I was like bitten by this fear, like, okay, I'm not gonna end up in my life as a kupamanduk or whatever. And then it so happened, whatever, my wife and I, we made a decision, we moved to Seattle. And believe it or not, 2 weeks here and I felt Seattle was home. And I'm a very sun person. I kind of inwardly believe that I could have a seasonal afflicted depression if I don't see the sun. But living in Seattle, even for the 2 weeks, I found, you know, I love my snow-capped mountains. I love the picture perfectness. I love the water. And in many ways, Seattle is like Bangalore. For one, Bangalore is very metropolitan. And Seattle, I found in the 2 weeks I was working on one floor in T-Mobile, which was then called VoiceStream, I met people from 20 or 25 countries in on one little floor. How much more cosmopolitan can you get? And then the weather, of course. Bangalore, the joke is you have four seasons. You see all of them every day. Seattle is not that far from the truth, right? We've seen days where it snowed in the morning. You've seen the sun come out a couple of hours later, and then we've gone back to cloud. So all this, and then there was no going back. So I see myself as a hardcore Seattleite. And believe it or not, I still go to Bangalore very often. And a few weeks is good. But afterwards, it's not that I don't feel I belong there. I kind of get this longing to be back in Seattle. And so that's really what it is. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring the Storywallahs Belonging Event. It took place on April 23rd at ACT Theater. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Again, you can hear the complete version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.